Francis Parker Yockey, born September 18, 1917, died in a jail cell, allegedly from a cyanide pill that he took in June 16, 1960, was an American attorney, a political philosopher. His most seminal work, Imperium, was said to be a continuance, a post-World War II continuance of Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West. In this video, we will pull from Imperium and look at Yockey's opinions on America, from its creation to its future. We start with the origins of America. The America continent was populated by individual migration. A great number of these immigrants came from the northern races of Europe during the period of 1500 to 1890s. During the colonial period, 1500 to 1789, the life conditions under which the incoming settlers lived were rigorous in the extreme. The hinterland was populated by hostile savages. The secure territory was a narrow strip of seaboard, some 1,500 miles long. Beyond that was the vast, unexplored, unknown frontier. This word, an important one in understanding the national souls of the former nations of Europe, had an entirely opposite significance in America. Instead of a boundary between two power units, it referred to an area, vast, dangerous, and almost empty. It needed only to be conquered in order to be incorporated, and in this process, the greatest enemy was nature, rather than the savages, for in no case were the latter highly organized. Thus, America did not develop in the early centuries the consciousness of political tension which arises from a true frontier. Whether or not a man penetrated into the hinterland to take the land there for his own was a matter of his personal will. These millions of quadrate kilometers were not developed by state action, but by individual imperialism. This fact also is of the highest importance for subsequent American history. In the first place, these immigrants had in general the characteristic Gothic urge into the distance which had given to Western history its unique intensity. Whether they were adventurers or religious refugees, merchants or soldiers, they nevertheless left their European homes for an unknown and dangerous land of privation and primitive conditions. The new conditions under which they lived perpetuated and developed the instincts which had brought them there. In small groups, these early Americans cleared the forest, built forts and homes. The farmers plowed the fields with rifles slung over their shoulders. The women worked in the homes with weapons at hand. The human characteristics encouraged were self-reliance, resourcefulness, bravery, independence. Cities grew up along the coasts, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and in these cities arose, in the 18th century, something resembling a society. So, early American history, obviously, cities forming around the coastline, people with the manifest destiny mentality going into the untamed lands to create their own lands or their own opportunities there. Most of the colonial propagandists, Samuel Adams, Patrick Henry, Thomas Paine, John Adams, John Hancock, Thomas Jefferson, and Benjamin Franklin, had been in England and France and had thus absorbed the new rationalistic idea which had triumphed in English society and was conquering the French state and culture. The colonials adopted the French form of the rationalist doctrines, demanding the rights of man rather than the rights of Americans. Hamilton, who Yockey believes was America's greatest statesman, Hamilton wanted a monarchical state on European traditionary lines, but rationalist ideology and propaganda was too strong to be overcome, and these demanded a republic. The individual rights that were set down in various documents had no analogy to European conditions. Since there had never been a state in America, and had never been a frontier in the European sense, there had only been individuals. Land could be acquired by claiming it and settling on it. Any man who wished could at any time take his gun, go into the hinterland, and there live as a farmer or trapper. Thus, the talk of individuals was nothing new, and furthermore, it represented no parallel to European conditions. Since the state was the basis of the life of persons in Europe, It was only because there was a state in Europe that the individual was able to live and prosper. If there had been no Prussian state, half of the population of Europe would have passed into Slavic conditions. In other words, the states in Europe formed of specific culture, tradition, and ethos of people protected them, allowed them to be individuals, but protected them from the frontier, which was the neighboring city-state, or the different culture, or the different religion, etc. So America never really having that threat in its youth, never having materialized the concept of the state. There had been no state in America. The closest thing to a state had been faraway English government, and hence the American anti-state ideology was not denying any fact of life, but was merely affirming the fact of individualism, which had grown out of the empty and vast landscape. State is a unit of opposition. There were no other states on the North American continent, and thus no American state could arise. The American ideology. The basic idea, as in all rationalism, is the equating of what ought to be with what will be. Rationalism begins with confusing the rational with the real and ends by confusing the real with the rational. This arsenal of truths about equality, inalienable, and inherent rights reflects the emancipated critical spirit devoid of respect for facts and tradition. The idea that governments are instituted for a utilitarian purpose to satisfy demand of equal men, and that these equal men give their consent to a certain form of government and then abolish it when it no longer serves the purpose, is pure rationalistic poetry and corresponds to no facts that had ever occurred anywhere. This source of government is the inequality of men. This is a fact. The nature of government is a reflection of the culture, the nation, and the stage of development of both. Nations are the creations of high culture, and in their last essence are mystical ideas. Their coming, their individualities, their form, their going, are all reflections of higher cultural developments. To say that a nation is dedicated to a proposition is to reduce it to an abstraction that can be put on a blackboard for the instruction of a class in logic. It is a rationalistic caricature of the nation idea. So to speak of a nation is to insult and debase it. No one would ever die for a logical proposition. If such a proposition, which is also claimed to be self-evident, is not convincing, armed force will not make it more so. The Newman liberty is one of the main focus of the American ideology. The word can only be defined negatively, as freedom from some restraint or another. Not even the most rabid American ideologist advocates total freedom from every form of order. And similarly, the strictest tyranny has never wished to forbid everything. In the practical sense, American freedom means freedom from the state, but it is obvious that this is mere literature, since there never was a state in America, nor any necessity for one. The word freedom is thus merely a concept in a materialistic religion that describes nothing in the world of American facts. The ideas of the Constitution were mostly derived from the writings of Montesquieu. The idea of separation of powers, in particular, comes from this French theorist. According to this theory, the powers of government are three: legislative, executive, and judicial. Like all crystal clear rationalistic thinking, this is muddy and confused when applied to life. These powers can only be separated on paper. In life, they cannot. Also important to American ideology was the feeling of universality. Although the War of Succession had nothing whatsoever to do with ideology of any kind, and in any case, the Southern legalistic rationale of the war was more consequent than a Yankee idea, Lincoln felt impelled to inject the issue of ideology into the war. The opponent could never be simply a political rival bent upon the same power as the Yankee. He had to be a total enemy, intent upon wiping out the American ideology. This feeling informed all American wars from that time onward. Any political enemy was regarded ipso facto as an ideological opponent, even though the enemy had no interest whatsoever in American ideology. And hence, every war is about, you know, spreading democracy or protecting democracy now. In the 20th century, when the rationalistic type of ideology has been discarded by the advancing Western civilization, the American universalizing of ideology turned into messianism, the idea that America must save the world. The vehicle of the salvation is to be a materialistic religion with democracy taking the place of God, constitution the place of the church, principles of government the place of religious dogmas, and the idea of economic freedom in the place of God's grace. The technique of salvation is to embrace the dollar, or, failing that, to submit to American high explosives and bayonets. The American ideology is a religion, just as was the rationalism of the French Terror, of Jacobinism, of Napoleonism. And that's a technique America still uses today. It's either you accept the dollar, you know, you open up to Hollywood, the multinational corporations, big tech, or if you fail to do that, you're going to submit to bombs being dropped on you in the name of democracy. The ideology of a people is merely intellectual clothing. It may or may not correspond to the instinct of that people. An ideology may be changed from day to day, but not the character of the people. Once that is formed, it is definite and influences events far more than they can influence it. The character of the American people was formed in the Succession War. So let's get into the War of Succession, otherwise known as the Civil War. The War of Succession, 1861-1865. When the power is obtained by majorities in elections, the science of electioneering develops. Voters must be organized in order that leaders may perpetuate themselves in office, and the technique of organization is the party. Organizations takes funds and it takes ideals. These ideals are for the masses of voters. The funds make it possible to spread them. The funds are more important because they are difficult to procure, whereas ideals are plentiful. This dependence of party organization upon a supply of funds brought about the situation in which rich men were able to make the party leaders and party organizations run things to please them. Even a party leader in office was not independent, for the rich man alone could keep him there. The name given in the books of this type of government is plutocracy, the rule of money. This was the American form during the whole 19th century, and it continued to the year 1933. The source of wealth of the richest men in America during the period of 1789 to 1861 was manufacturers and trade. The richest men were found in the northern states, the manufacturing and trading places. The southern states had a totally non-plutocratic organization. A society arose there on a patriarchal and hierarchical basis. Half of the population belonged to the African race and was held as slaves by white landowners and planters. Slavery was less efficient than industrialism. For capitalistic purposes, because the slaves enjoyed complete security, protection against illness, unemployment, old age, whereas the northern factory workers were as completely unprotected in these respects. This gave the northern industrialists one more advantage over the humanitarian slave owner. The industrialists' cost of production were cheaper. Factory workers who were wiped out by illness or other catastrophe were not the responsibility of the industrialists. They had only the disadvantages of slavery, whereas the Africans in the South had its advantages as well. So essentially, the slave owner, they couldn't afford, you know, their slaves to die on them, so they had to keep them healthy. They had to keep them fed. They had to keep them strong, in a sense. So they have to invest a lot more in the slave than the capitalists had to invest in the worker, which there's a lot of irony there, but that was just the reality of it. And this is why he's saying the humanitarian slave owner, because essentially, even though people would disagree with that, essentially saying the slave owner had to actually take care of his slave in order to keep that slave working, you know, for his own interest, but he still had to take care of them. industrialist, the capitalist, they really had no motive of taking care of their worker because they can just get another worker. It doesn't even matter to them. The South was thus less mobilized economically than the North and consequently desired the cheapest possible manufacturers, which meant at the time English imports. Northern industry could not compete well with English imports and demanded a high protective tariff. The tariff issue was the focus of a political struggle for 3 decades before the war finally broke out. And it's unfortunate the Civil War always gets dumbed down to a war about slavery when it was essentially a war about 2 different countries struggling for power. The South was united behind states' rights and a weaker central government, while the North was for the strong central government. Slavery just being one of the hot-button issues like you see in every political divide of people. Once any issue from whatever sphere of life it derives becomes sufficiently intense to become political, no other motives come in to support it. Thus, Yankee ideologists fastened on the idea of slavery and made it a war issue for the masses in the northern states. The financial labor exploitation of the northern capitalists was held up as humanitarianism, and the patriarchal care of the southern planter was branded as cruelty, inhumanity, and immoral. The ideological side of this war presaged coming American war conduct. Napoleon had calculated from his experience on 150 fields of battle that the ratio in warfare of the spiritual to the material is as 3 is to 1. Assuming this to be true, the defeat of the South was the result of Yankee material superiority of more than 3 times. This war had many lessons for Europe, but was mostly ignored in the European capitals, which were still in the nationalistic petty state period and not capable of large space thinking. It showed the enormous military potentiality in America. It showed the Yankee character, which was thenceforth to be the American spirit. It showed the numerous will to power of the New York plutocracy. It showed, in short, that the base for the world power had been laid here. The only European power which noticed it was the only one capable at the time of large space thinking. England, and England's attitude toward the war, was throughout one of benevolent neutrality towards the South, to say the least. The American practice of government. The actual form of the government of America was a plutocracy, but the technique through which this government was maintained was usually taken by superficial thinkers to be a real government. The great epoch in the history of practice of government in America is 1828. In that year, Andrew Jackson was elected president of the central government, and he immediately announced the new conception of office holding as private economics. With his slogan, "To the victors belongs the spoils," he dethroned forever the Federalist idea of tradition of state service. Government henceforth was spoils for successful party politicians. The election of 1828 was the last appearance of the Federalist Party in an election. It retained for itself, however, control of the federal judiciary until the middle of the 19th century. Jackson's election also put an end to the aristocratic Congressional caucus method of choosing the presidential candidates. Thenceforth, the parties had nominating conventions for this purpose. The forces of tradition, which had been concentrated in the Federalist Party, no longer appeared in inner politics as an organized group. Their only remaining significance was social. Thus, during the 19th century in America, there was no conflict of the European variety between party and tradition, between the Constitution mongers, the American practice of government, and the aristocratic forces of monarchy, state, army, church. The Constitution idea meant 3 different things in America, in England, and on the continent. In America, the Constitution was the symbol of the beginning of the people. In England, the unwritten Constitution represented the organic link of the history of the English national soul binding together past and future. On the continent, Constitution represented the gathering point of all anti-traditionary forces to break with the organic past. and the attempt to destroy state and society. In America, there was no tradition, but only a constitution. In England, constitution and tradition were synonymous. On the continent, constitution and tradition were antitheses. The first administration in America was the Federalist government of Washington and Hamilton. Hamilton established already in 1791 the doctrine of implied powers in the central government as a measure for strengthening the central government. This was, of course, entirely against the letter and spirit of the Constitution, which delegated certain powers to the central government and reserved all other powers to the states. Thenceforth, two ideas separated out: the ideas of a strong central government and the states' rights idea. This issue was the focus of secessionist movements, first in the northern states and later in the southern states, and theoretical formulation of the war between the states, 1861-1865, was based on the right of a state to secede from the Union. During the whole 19th century, except for the political issue which created the secession war, America was a country without true politics. Inner politics was simply business, and any group could engage in it to further its own economic or ideological interest. In addition to parties, the usage of lobbies developed. The lobby is the means of exerting pressure on legislators after election. Private groups send private representatives to the legislator, and there they persuade office holders by bribes of votes and money to support, introduce, or oppose legislation. Agrarian groups, racial groups, economic groups, societies of every description use this method. By this means, the anti-alcohol societies introduced nationwide prohibition of the manufacture, sale, or transportation of alcoholic liquors. This political technique continues. After the defeat of the Federalist Party early in the 19th century, there was a constant tread towards widening the suffrage, supported by all parties and only opposed by social traditionary forces. Party always wants the widest possible suffrage, since this completely deprives the electorate of power. If 10 men decide in an election, they all have some power, at least. But if 10 million compromise the electorate, the masses deprive the higher elements of any significance. So essentially destroying any real semblance of a aristocratic class, where at least you have specific individuals invested in the power, and now giving it to the masses, where it comes down to pandering simply. And when Yaki's talking about the Constitution, there was no real form of government, and essentially it was a plutocracy since the Constitution. One can even look to, there's an interesting book entitled The Economic Interpretation of the Constitution by historian Charles A. Beard. And this book simply goes into the finances of all the people involved in the Constitution. And what it shows was over 90 some odd percent of them were the elite as far as financially at that time in the country. Either lawyers coming from Ivy League schools, land speculators, merchants, etc. So of course the Constitution was essentially a business agreement created by them. The inner development of America has followed the invariable pattern of democracy, observable in all cultures and all states. Party politics is tied to commercialism, rationalism, materialism, economic activity. With the spirit of the age of resurgence of authority, party politics gives way to authoritarian forms, regardless of theories or techniques employed. The power is simply there for an ambitious man or group to take. Let's go into the history of American imperialism. The inner imperialism, so to speak, continued unrelentingly. The aboriginal inhabitants of the continent, whose wishes were never consulted either by the European powers or by the Americans, whether of the colonies or of the Union, resisted unceasingly the steady westward drive of American imperialism. The answer of the Americans to this resistance by the Red Indians was the formula: the only good Indian is a dead Indian. American merchants supplied the Indians with arms, powders, and shot, and thus the Indian Wars continued down to the beginning of the 20th century. Despite the money payments, for which European powers had given up vast claims, the Indians relinquished theirs only to superior American force. At that time, the American practice and theory were the same. Might makes right. Treaty after treaty was made with Indian tribes, laying down frontiers over which Americans agreed not to pass. Each treaty was violated by the American imperial instinct. Such treaty violations gave rise to the Black Hawk War, the Seminole Wars, and to a century-long series of wars which only ended with the political annihilation of the Indians. In 1890, the last Sioux War was ended, and thereafter Indian resistance to American imperialism was scattered and local. Hawaii's turn had to come, and soon a revolt prepared Hawaii for American annexation. This was mere preparation for an imperialistic venture on a larger scale than anything yet attempted. In 1898, Spain's possessions in the Caribbean and Pacific were attacked. As a result of the Spanish-American War, most of Spain's colonial empire was transferred to America, including the valuable Philippines and Cuba. In passing, the Pacific islands of Tutuila, Guam, Wake, Midway, and Samoa had been annexed. In all of this, one thing must be noted. American imperialism was purely instinctive. It was neither intelligent nor intellectualized, like contemporary European imperialism. No public man ever advocated the building of an American empire, and few even recognized openly what was going on. It would in fact have been indignantly denied that America was an imperialistic power. It is true that the phrase manifest destiny as an apology for imperialism came into use around the turn of the 20th century, but there was no definite imperial policy or program. The colonies were acquired in a planless, purely instinctive fashion without regard to position, significance, or economic value. William Jennings Bryan, in his speech on imperialism, August 8, 1900, did warn America against entering on a career of empire because it would destroy the American form of government, saying, "We cannot repudiate the principle of self-government in the Philippines without weakening that principle here." But he was not heard, and the tradition of confidence that had taken root during a century of successful imperialistic ventures without a setback was not to be undermined by a minatory speech. Nor was the opposite aspect of Bryan's warning heard. What he meant by self-government was the habit of class war, constitutionalized civil war, freedom for everyone to gouge and exploit everyone else within his limits of the criminal law. Thus, his admonition meant an imperial nation cannot have internal disorganization and formlessness. There was no class, however, in America interested in anything else except self-enrichment. And so no one concerned himself with such questions, except a few writers like Homer Lee. Imperial situations are ever-changing, and one must be prepared for reverses. In that case, the home conditions must also be in order if the outer developments are to be mastered. In a country where even the word politics was completely misunderstood and meant corrupt economics, it could not be expected that a political wisdom would be present that would inform the leadership that the empire means war, and the war presupposes internal order. In very fact, there was no leadership to tell. Every few years, a new group of representatives of private economic interest were installed in the administration of government, and there was no traditional policy, internal or external. The American Revolution of 1933. The American War for Independence, 1775 to 1783, was regarded by two different types of participants in two different aspects. The creative leader types like Hamilton, Washington, Franklin, Rutledge saw it as an international war between an American nation in the formative stage and England. This American nation was to them a new idea, and the various ideological slogans and ideals which were used as propaganda material were not the essence, but only the temporary clothing of the new national idea. For undertypes like Samuel Adams, Thomas Paine, and Thomas Jefferson, however, the war was a class war, and the independence idea was only a technique for actualizing the equality ideals of rationalistic literature. The implementation of these equality ideals have always taken the form of jealousy, hatred, and social destruction in America and Europe. The class warriors regarded the war as a struggle for equality, not a fight for American national independence. They hated monarchy, leadership, discipline, quality, aristocracy, anything superior and creative. The nation idea, imminent in the minds of the creators led by Hamilton, was the healthy and natural organic ranking of the population from top down, with a monarch and aristocracy at the top, educated from birth to the idea of service of the national idea. They conceived already at that early stage the idea of a planned American imperialism over the hinterland of the continent and in the Caribbean. The two ideas continued through the history of America. Class war is an autopathic culture disease which arises with the beginnings of a civilization crisis and is only finally liquidated with the end of that crisis in the beginning of the second phase of civilization, the resurgence of authority. And we're definitely today in a resurgence of authority. It's just whose authority is it going to be? A populist authority or the tyrannical authority of the financial elites? America's entire history up to now has been with the first organic phase of civilization, which set in for the Western culture about 1750, triumphed in 1800, and is now inwardly accomplished. Class war has thus always been looked upon as natural and normal in America, instead of an expression of a great cultural crisis with an origin, direction, and end. The class war forces led by Jefferson at the time of the founding of the American Union in 1789 have been in the unique situation in which there was no ideology whatsoever opposed to them. Since the defeat of the Federalist Party in 1828, there had been no spiritual but only crude economic resistance to class war in America. That it has proceeded to lengths of destruction in America to which it never could proceed in Europe is owing, however, not to this alone, but to the presence of extra Western forces. These forces have intervened in the public life of America and of necessity have distorted that life and warped it away from its Western origins. The very nature of a colony, as has been seen, not only generates centrifugal political tendencies, but also weakens the bond with the mother soil of the culture whence the inner life of the colony derives. This makes the colonial area one of low culture sensitivity and low resisting power to extra-cultural forces. It is this low resisting power to subcultural and extra-cultural forces that has brought about the obsession with economics and has allowed the unparalleled influx of cultural aliens to take place over the past half century. Toward the end of the century began the Jewish immigration, and shortly thereafter the influx of Balkan, Slavs, Russians, and Eastern Mediterranean people. Feeble defensive measures were taken, like the Immigration Act of 1890, which put a quota on populations from each European country, calculated so as to favor Northern European immigrants over Slavs and Levantines. None of this, however, affected the Jew, for, stemming from a different culture, his movements are invisible statistically to Western nations. He came in under the English quota, the German quota, the Irish quota, and every other. The world feeling of rationalism, which begets materialism, money obsession, decline of authority, and political pluralism, worked against assimilation, and the culture distorters increased in social power and significance. Assimilation was deliberately held up in order to keep America in a spiritually disarticulated, divided, and chaotic condition. Defensive efforts on the part of Americans of nationalistic feelings to restrict or abolish immigration were frustrated by culture distortion. Between 1900 and 1915, 15 million aliens immigrated into America. Few came from Western Europe. Nearly all were from Southern Eastern Europe, from Russia, Poland, and Asia Minor. Included in these masses were Jews, whose numbers are estimated in the millions. The First World War interrupted the immigration river, but it was resumed after the war and was accelerated mightily by the European Revolution of 1933. The Jews who fled or were expelled from Europe went to America en masse. Well, if he thought all that immigration was bad, it would have blown his mind to see the 1965 Hart-Celler Act, which essentially changed the future and possibilities of this country forever. It is worth noting that the lower culture exclusiveness in colonial areas has resulted in Jews being treated for civil purposes the same as Europeans from 1737 onwards in the American colonies, whereas a century had to elapse before this rationalistic policy triumphed completely on the home soil of the Western culture. The only reason for it in the colonies was, of course, the fact there were no Jews as a group, but only a few scattered individuals who were regarded as curiosities. From 1890 on began the Jewish invasion of America. Within the next 50 years, the number of Jews in America increased from negligible proportions to a number estimated between 8 and 12 million. New York City became, in this period, predominantly a Jewish capital. Of this Jewish immigration, approximately 80% were Ashkenazi Jews. American reaction inevitably began against the phenomena, which inevitably accompanied the immigration of these vast numbers with their own world feeling, who immediately began to influence the American life in every sphere and on every plane. A clever propaganda-making use of American ideology to serve Jewish purposes was the answer to this reaction. America became a melting pot, after the phrase of the Jew Israel Zangwill. And the purely quantitative American ideology lent this picture convincingness in an America still in the money obsession stage. The word American was changed by the same propaganda to mean an immigrant who had improved his personal circumstances by coming to America, and to exclude the Native American who was displaced by the immigrant. If the latter showed resentment, the family actually born in America, he was called un-American. Thus, Native American movements like the second Ku Klux Klan formed in 1915 as an expression of the reaction of the American organism to the presence of the foreign matter were more or less successfully called un-American by the propaganda organs in America, which even by that time had come under strong culture-distorting influences. And any time he's referring to, in this segment of the book where he's referring to culture distorters in America, he's largely speaking about the Jewish people because they had the power to culturally distort. So it's not only being an alien culture within you, but it's that alien culture having the ability to actually change, influence the culture. The words America and American were stripped of all spiritual national significance and were given a purely ideological significance. Anyone who came to America was ipso facto an American, regardless of the facts that he retained his own language, lived in his own racial national group, nourished his old connections with Russia, Southeastern Europe, or the Eastern Mediterranean, and had a purely economic relationship with America. And that's largely the same today, and that's largely why it is like that today. While America is looked at as a business contract, essentially. I've come here to make more money, have a bigger house, have more cars, have more comfort. But there's really nothing there outside, you know, vague, empty concepts like freedom and liberty. Americans of native stock, however, the representatives before history of the new unit in the Western civilization called the American people, were not ipso facto Americans. If they nourished any national feelings of exclusiveness, whatever, they were un-American. This transvaluation of values is an invariable accompaniment of cultural distortion and represents a superpersonal life necessity of the culture distorting element. The values of the host culture or host colony are hostile to the life of the culture distorter, and for him to adopt them would be to disappear as a higher unit. Assimilation of the Jew would mean that there would no longer be a Jewish idea, a Jewish culture, state, nation, people, religion, race. In fighting against nationalistic feelings in America, the Jew idea is fighting for its continued existence against the hostile Western civilization. It is a tribute to the political skill of the leaders of Jewry that they were able in the 20th century to identify their Jewish idea with America and to label the nationalism of America with the term un-American, which still goes on to this very day. For the inner history of America, four epochs had great significance: 1789, 1828, 1865-1933. 1789 marked the formation of the Union of Colonies through the adoption of the Constitution. 1828 marked the final defeat of the Federalist Party, the sole authoritarian force in the Union. 1865 was the complete financialization of the continent, but also the formation of the specific character of the American people. With 1865, however, the last barrier to economic obsession was removed and the road was paved that was to eventuate in the utter triumph of the culture distorter in 1933. Talking about the Roosevelt administration. Future Western history will write down this date as the year of the American Revolution, or more accurately, as the first phase of the American Revolution. For in that year, culture distortion began to penetrate the remaining spheres of American life, government, army, administration, judiciary. Yet this epoch passed unnoticed, not only to the great mass of Americans, for that is not surprising, but also to many of the custodians of the American national feeling. Keen political instincts in the cultural aliens had given them a complete mastery of the techniques of the American party contests, and they proceeded to monopolize the opposing party. So thenceforward, elections were mere pageantry and no longer contained the possibility of a real charge of government, but only the substitution of one culture-distorting party for another. Culture distortion in America, as elsewhere in the Western civilization, was only able to twist, warp, and frustrate the soul of the host. It could neither kill it nor transform it. American autopathic tendencies arising from the disintegratory influence of rationalism and materialism are the source of the possibilities of which the culture distorter made use. His technique was to push them even further in the direction of decadence, but at the same time, he could always refer to rationalistic doctrines, themselves products of the civilization crisis, as a semi-religious basis for his disintegratory work. Thus, the equality rhetoric of the Independence of Declaration of 1775 and pious platitudes from Lincoln and other party politicians were used as a basis of the tolerance propaganda, which teaches Americans that they must not in any way, not even in thought, discriminate against the Jew. This propaganda is spread from the highest official places down to the level of home, school, and church. It is necessary to observe precisely the spiritual products of the culture distortion in America, in every sphere of life, for the America that intervenes in Europe is not the true America, which still existed in 1890, but an empire consisting of a master stratum with its own culture and a great mass of subjects compromising the Americans and the almost equally numerous alien thinking groups. The lower strata supply the soldiers who invade Europe, but the brains who decide belong to non-Americans. Let's go into the world outlook of America. In the rationalistic and materialistic atmosphere of 19th century America, there was only a very weak link with the sublime Western Gothic traditions of spiritualized meaning of life. But under the culture-distorting regime since 1933, America has been completely disenchanted. On every plane, the ultimate reality of the world and life is materialistic. The aim of life is happiness. This must be so, since life itself is only physiochemical process, and articles appear which treat as imminent the discovery of a formula for life by scientists. Such a thing as great as spiritual movement or national rising is not understood in America. First, because it has had nothing of that kind in its history. And secondly, because the distorter has made all such things ridiculous. The American is taught that life is a process of cultivating friendly relations with all, joining as many clubs and secret societies as possible, and confining all his thought and effort to the personal plane. The happy end is the ideal of life and literature. There is no thought of bearing up under the bitterest and most crushing blows of fate. These are overcome by avoiding one's glance. The lucky man, and not the man who has suffered in silence and become stronger, is the central figure in the happy end literature. The opposition between the Western idea of destiny fulfillment and the culture distorter's disintegrating substitute called Happy End, is actually the focal idea of the world outlook that he wishes to force upon the prostrate American nation and its parent Western civilization. The irreconcilability between these two ideas extends from the personal plane upward through the national economy, society, state, religion, and ethics. The great Western life feeling is the necessity of being oneself, of preserving that within one which cannot be compromised, which is synonymous with soul, destiny, honor, race. The distorter's idea of happy end is opportunistic, weak, degenerate, and revolting to the Western honor feeling. The empty, smiling face, the uniform mind, the senseless chasing after noise, movement, and sensation, the obsession with money making and money spending, the rejection of all spiritual standards of attainment. All this merely reflects the basic interpretation of life as seeking for a happy end. For happiness, one will compromise anything, give anything, sell anything. Happiness becomes synonymous with the pursuit of economic and sexual motives. It absolutely excludes any profitless struggle against odds, merely in order to become oneself. Understanding respect for the tragedy of life, the magic of life, the power of idea are precluded by the happy ending feeling. Happy end has a purely negative significance. It is a denial of life, an escape from life. It is thus a deception and an untruth. The racial chaos in America, which deliberately perpetuated by the distorter, delivers the American nation more securely into his hands, is only possible because of the denationalizing program of Americans. This program begins with propaganda in the schools to the effect that America was not colonized, cleared, and conquered or built by Americans, but by a great conglomeration of aliens. The contributions of the Jew and the Negro are taught as the decisive formative influences on the American dream. In New York State, Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice is forbidden to be taught in the schools. The promoting of anti-spiritual and anti-national happy end idea with its economic and sexual obsession and its social atomism is a prerequisite of continuing the whole program of degeneration. Races and nations express themselves at their highest potential in strong individuals who embody the prime national characteristics and acquire immense historical symbolic significance. Therefore, the efforts of the culture distorter to strangle American nationalism take the form of the offensive against individualism, not against freakish, insane individualism, but against the only kind that is historically effective, individualism which concentrates in itself a higher idea and is devoted to its service. So not extreme individualism as what is promoted, especially with the conservative side and libertarians and all of this, but the individualism to be a unique character, but in the pursuit of serving the community, in the pursuit of raising the community. And this is essentially the history of great men. And this is what Yaki is saying, where the true expression of all the potentiality of a people, a race, a culture, a religion usually comes through an individual that is able to encompass everything that is good and materialize it into action. The Negro in America. The population of America only consists now of a bare majority that is indisputably American racially, spiritually, nationally. The other half consists of Negroes, Jews, unassimilated Southern Eastern Europeans, Mexican, Chinese, Japanese, Siamese, Levantine, Slavs, and Indians. The mass ideals of noise, excitement, mental uniformity, and hurrying movement, which essentially defines what America is today, which the Americans share with the unassimilated alien groups, do not represent any kind of assimilation, because these traits themselves are anti-national, demoralizing, destructive of individuality, state, people, race. So he's saying, look, our love, our shared desire and pleasures of, noise, excitement, mental uniformity, and hurrying movement, that's not enough to keep a nation together, because these aren't real binding things for a nation. To a finance capitalist, however, a Negro merely represents cheap labor or a prospect for a small loan. The master of money knows nothing of nation, people, race, culture. He is a realist, which means, on the primitive intellectual level, that he regards everything which is as the sum total of reality. Actually, of course, that which is represents a stage already passed, an idea already accomplished. True reality is the future at work, for this is the impetus of events. Thus, no money thinker would ever think two or three generations into the future, for he regards larger conditions as stable, even though he seeks instable in immediate conditions. The converting of the Negro into a slave wage has demoralized him completely, made him into a discontented proletarian, and created in him a deep racial bitterness. The soul of the Negro remains primitive and childlike in comparison with the nervous and complicated soul of Western man, accustomed to thinking in terms of money and civilization. The result is that the Negro has become a charge of white society. Marriage is almost unknown among the Negroes, and the women raise the large families. In the large cities, the Negro population supplies approximately 10 times as many criminals as its numbers would indicate to be its proportion. Social diseases are general among his race, and the hospitals as well as the penitentiaries deal with highly disproportionate number of Negroes. Primitive violence is natural to Negroes, and the sense of social disgrace is lacking in him in connection with crimes. Negro sections of the northern cities are dangerous to the life of white persons. So even in the 50s, you're having that problem. I find it interesting where he says primitive violence is natural to the Negro, and the sense of social disgrace is lacking in him in connection with crimes. And you see that today. It's like they brag about the crimes and all this. And you talk about primitive violence, killing people over shoes, chains, jackets, for looking at you wrong, etc., etc. This is all very primitive violence, and it still manifests today because it's never really been addressed on a large scale, because there was no benefit to the money system, right, to the elites in addressing that. It's better to keep them in the primitive violence. It's better to keep them, a people in general, lacking of this social disgrace and actually, you know, bragging about their criminal culture. Like all primitive races, the Negro race is fertile and possessed of strong instincts. His numbers today, including the mulattoes, are approximately 14 million. This 10% of the total population of America is an adjunct of the program of the culture distorter. Politically, this mass is organized as a unit and supported the Roosevelt regime from the time of its seizure of power in 1933. The Negro has been the focus of much of the revolutionary activity of the culture distorting regime. From time to time, the distorter raises a racial issue publicly, in which the white Southerner is made the public enemy and the Negro is the hero of democracy. This results in increasingly serious race war in the northern and southern cities. Does that sound familiar? I mean, it's the same method today. But now it's like even black criminals, they turn into, you know, these martyrs and these symbols of democracy and the evil white cops now, or the evil white people that would dare do this, or the evil white person that would dare defend himself, etc., etc. Same propaganda, same method, but it works so well. It works so well and it's got them so far. So why would they ever change it up? Especially when most people don't see it, don't realize it, don't want to see it because they're too busy looking for their happy end life. The Negro has suffered more than anyone in being thrown into slavery of finance exploitation and into the conscription of the race war program of the distorter. From the happy, deeply and primitive religious cotton-picking slave, with the complete protection and insulation from the dynasm of Western industrialism, he has been made into a malcontented, diseased fighter in a race and class war. His life has been made into a round of factories, hospital, public relief offices, jails, and roaming of the streets. The new Negro is a dangerous potentiality, and he has been fitted out by the distorter with a program of demands, an ideology of his own, with a Bolshevist framework and a dynamic leadership. A Negro writer has recently said, and listen to this because this is the theme of what you hear today as well, especially, your land, This is the writer he's referring to. Your land? How did it become yours? We were here before the pilgrims landed. Hither we brought our three gifts and mixed them with yours. The gift of poetry and of song, tender and living melodies into badly harmonized and unmelodious land. The gift of sweat and muscle power to defeat the wilderness and conquer the ground of this wide, rich country 200 years before your weak, white hands could have done it. The third gift, the gift of soul. Are these gifts worth nothing? Is this no work and striving? Could America have become America without its Negro folk? This does not represent merely the thought of one mulatto, for these ideas have been drummed into the heads of millions of the Negroes in the cities, not to mention the white element of weak instincts, the liberal element which gives in to the race war and thus encourages it. The Negro has a will strong enough to push his demands through, and today there are Negroes on all levels of public life, officers, judges, administrators, labor leaders, lawyers, doctors, professors. For America, there are two aspects to the Negro problem, the immediate and the long range. Immediately, the Negro movement is completely in the service of culture distortion, which controls all phases of domestic Bolshevism in America. An inner crisis in which many issues of the American public life will simultaneously present themselves monstrous in their size and demands, will confront the American people in the near future. When, no one can tell, but it is inevitable, for America is no exception to the 5 millennia of history of high cultures and their colonies. Amen. The position of the Negro vis-a-vis the organic existence of the American people is quite clear. The long-range aspect of the problem is shown by the declining birth rate of the Native American population and the rising number of the Negro. The old white element is decreasing absolutely in numbers, and this process has been going on for 2 decades. Remember, he wrote this in 1950, or this was released in 1950, actually. The immediate relationship is spiritual-political. The more remote problem is spiritual-racial. All right, let's finish it off with the last aspect Yaki speaks on in regards to America, and that is the future of America. The origin of America contains its future. As Leibniz said, the present is loaded with the past and pregnant with the future. America originated as a colony of Western culture. The organic unity called a high culture is tied to its landscape of birth. Here it is born, and here it solves its last and mightiest problems. In its present stage, the Western civilization dominates the spiritual orientation of the whole world. In this age, the motivation of politics is derived from culture. The world divides into the Western civilization and that outside. A victory of Europe over Russia or India is a victory for America, and a victory of America over Japan or China is also one for Europe. America and Europe together constitute a spiritual unit. The possibility, thus, is real and organic that America and Europe will once again be politically united. That which shares a common destiny is actually a political unit, and the continuance of political disunity is artificial and hostile to the life interest of the organism. The prime aim of life is the actualizing of the possible. This is life. And that's something of a Faustian nature there. The prime aim of life is actualizing the possible. And that's definitely a course we've fallen off of for our happy end, as Yaki calls it, pursuit, which is just, you know, materialism, hedonism, the nihilism of modernity, of what we're living now, is what we were raised and nurtured in. But the organic idea of reunion is impossible of realization while the West is suffering from inner culture diseases. This possesses the question of reaction to culture pathology in America. The original stirrings of the soul of the American people were manifested by the early types of the independent, colonial, the pioneer, the militiaman, the explorer, the frontiersman. The characteristics of this type were resourcefulness, fearlessness, technical competence. It was simply the old Gothic urge into the distance once more, and the will to conquer that which lies between. The early American people had a powerful instinct of racial superiority coupled with its spirit of self-reliance. This human material was the basis of the Yankee type created by the War of Succession. That war had the result of engrafting onto its human material the form of the age of economics, money, and materialism. It was a natural result, for the entire Western civilization was at that time in the grip of the civilization crisis. The soul of the American people was formed in that upheaval. It is a late people, by which is meant technical, hard, externalized, but devoid of possibilities in the field of culture in a narrower sense. This hardness and externalization, this technical competence, will always remain in the American soul, for they are of its essence. The ideological trappings were mere clothing, and they belong to the spirit of the age. The 19th century spirit is quite dead, and America cannot perpetuate its carnal ideas any more than an organism can develop backwards from age to youth. The American ideology and world outlook have no future. The soul of the American people, however, has, for this people is an organism. The beating of this people into a thing of mass ideals, mass thinking, mass conduct, mass living was a distortion and an exaggeration of the tendencies of the American soul and of the possibilities of the age of materialism. The twisting and warping of the American destiny was only possible because of the diseases of culture retardation and culture distortion. Culture retardation in America was a reflex of the presence of the same disease in Europe. The age of materialism has been fortuitously victorious on the surface of history in the First World War, and the actualizing of the ideal of the 20th century in both America and Europe was thereby delayed. Culture distortion in America was a result of the presence in huge masses of a culturally alien group. The immediate future of America is therefore bound up with the culture distortion and the American reaction against it. The distribution of power, spiritual and material, must be assessed, which will be called into play. First, the culture distorting group. The numbers of the Jewish culture, nation, state, race in America are estimated between 8 and 12 million. The numbers are, however, not the first importance, for this organic unity has strong racial instincts and a powerful sense of a mission. The numbers do indeed play a part both in the extent of the culture distortion and the form and extent of the reaction against it. But the public power of the culture distorting group is based on its control of highly focused central organizations. In propaganda, its control is absolute. This covers cinema, the radio, the press, newspapers, periodicals, book, the universities, and the stage. The radio is controlled by means of a few large nationwide networks, which control the programs of the member stations, even though these may be privately owned. The newspaper press is dominated by its ownership of the few great news gathering associations, which control the presentation of the news of the member newspapers who are dependent on the association, even though they may be privately owned, and who may not change anything given them by the associations. Periodicals and books are controlled by means of ownership, in most cases, of the magazines, publishing houses, and printing presses, and social, economic, moral, legal compulsion for the other cases. The stage is controlled by ownership of the theaters and the other compulsory means. The universities are dominated by disproportionate numbers of the culture-distorting group, both in teaching and student personnel, as well as the organized and aggressive activity of these numbers. Both political parties are controlled by the culture-distorting group, forcing all the accepted kind of interpolitical activity in America into its service. The technique of political control is through a vast bureaucracy created since 1933, which is dominated and disproportionately staffed with members of the group. This administrative control is extended also over the armed forces. In the financial world, which completely owns and controls the industrial, the power of this group is heavily disproportionate to its population percentage. Its hold in this realm goes back to the War of Succession, when a few of the precursors of the invasion of 1890 to 1950 engaged in the arms traffic between the Confederate and Federal armies. selling guns to both sides. The result of all this is a powerful spiritual influence on the American people. This people reads the books which aliens write or edit for it. It sees the plays in cinema it is allowed to. It thinks the thoughts that are put into its head. It is thrown into the wars against America's interests, which it can only lose. The issue of war and peace, life and death, is decided for America by the cultural alien. And obviously nothing has changed to this day. Every war America's involved in does not benefit America, and America can only lose even when it wins. America has been given a Semitic countenance. Americans who hold power hold it in deference to the alien. To oppose him dare no public men. Americans were told that they must be concerned with the partitioning of Arabia. And no national channel existed through which an American could deny fundamentally the world picture which supported such a policy. But he who has looked into the essence of history knows that the alien and the proper cannot merge. They can only oppose one another. Disguise, terror, threats, dictatorship, pressure, propaganda, none of these can reach the essence of the relationship. The American people, not yet a nation, has its own soul, and it is only its lack of historical experience and the stage of development of the culture which created this people, which have made possible the wide critical diffusion of culture pathology throughout this people. The very fact of the culture distortion presupposes the existence, in its inner purity, of the soul of the host people. Distortion cannot destroy the host, but can only direct the energy of the host onto false problems and into the direction of the interests of the parasite. The hammering of the mass mind into the American people was at bottom merely a technique, an artifice. A strong individuality was submerged. It is true, but the strong individuality cannot be annihilated. The age of absolute politics will wake once more what there is of genius in the American stock. And a powerful reaction may be expected from the mass veneer over the American soul in the form of individual leaders upon whom absolute power will be conferred. America is not a country with creative possibilities in the field of philosophy, and its higher understanding of the great realities of our time will come from its deep, determining connection with the mother soil of the West. The elements which will enter into the coming struggle between American nationalism and the culture pathological element will be numerous. It is probably no longer possible for the American Revolution to take a constitutional form. The preferred parliamentary electoral techniques of late democratic conditions seem to exclude that possibility. There is left only civil war. In such a war, the race war between the Negro and the white, the class war of the unions against the managers, the financial war of the money dictators against the coming authoritarian nationalism, and the war for survival of the culture distorter against the American people will all step forth for resolution. Whether this crisis will be sharp and critical in nature, like the Succession War, or in the form of an uncertain and long drawn out evolution, like the 30-Year War, or the struggle between the spirit of Cromwell and the Restoration, cannot be foreseen. In any case, the struggle is one which is demanded by organic necessity, and only its occurrence can be foretold, but neither the form thereof nor the date thereof. These are imponderables. When the American National Revolution takes political form, its inspiration will come from the same ultimate source as the European Revolution of 1933. Therefore, what is written here is also for the true America. Even though the effective America of the moment and of the immediate future is a hostile America, an America of willing mass mind tools in the service of the culture distorting political and total enemy of the Western civilization. So Yaki leaves us with a belief of a coming struggle in America between the true American soul or the Western soul and against the culture distorters and everyone they've used as their pawns on the chessboard. Suggested reading for this video.